Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present journalist Ted Snyder, who examines hidden forces that may be behind Brazil's current political crisis that threatens to bring down the nation's leftist Workers' Party government. Tyson Slocum, director of Public Citizens Energy Program, who talks about how community solar programs can deliver the benefits of non-polluting cheap solar energy to all income groups. And author and activist Harvey Wasserman, who explains why he's concerned that the results of the 2016 U.S. election could be open to manipulation and outright theft. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Russian President Vladimir Putin boycotted the Nuclear Security Summit, a gathering of 50 world leaders meeting to tackle nuclear proliferation. The Russian leader snubbed this year's summit for what he said was a lack of mutual cooperation. However, the recent bombings in Brussels added a new sense of urgency to prevent extremist groups like ISIS from getting access to radioactive materials to make a dirty bomb. In Putin's absence, the focus turned to East Asia, as the U.S. and China agreed to press for new sanctions against North Korea in response to a recent nuclear test by the secretive Northeast Asian nation. During a side meeting at the summit, President Obama and Chinese President Xi Jinping agreed on a new consensus to confront North Korea's nuclear ambitions. Nuclear proliferation in East Asia has become an issue on the presidential campaign trail since GOP candidate Donald Trump suggested that Japan and South Korea should acquire nuclear weapons as a counterweight to North Korea. This would reverse decades of U.S. policy determined to limit the spread of nuclear weapons in Asia. Although Barack Obama began his presidency by pledging to reduce the dangerous role of nuclear weapons in the world, the Nobel Peace Prize winner is ending his time in office by ordering the modernization of the U.S. nuclear arsenal over the next 3 decades at an estimated cost of nearly $1 trillion. Conservatives who control the Arizona state legislature are moving to dismantle the state's Clean Election Campaign Finance Law enacted in the late 1990s. The move could unleash a new wave of secret dark money in campaigns led by the conservative billionaire Koch brothers. Republican Secretary of State Michelle Reagan, who is leading the drive to gut the Clean Elections Commission, won her last election with an 11th-hour injection of dark money from a conservative group that paid for a blitz of TV ads against her Democratic Party opponent. The bill would remove enforcement of Arizona's campaign disclosure rules from the Citizens Clean Elections Commission and give it to the Federal Internal Revenue Service. Robert McGuire of the Center for Responsive Politics told the American Prospect magazine, "The IRS is about as good at effective, timely oversight over politically motivated nonprofits as a sea cucumber is at chess. Federal agency enforcement lags far behind elections," explains McGuire, meaning that even when agencies do go after secret spenders, the candidates who benefited have often already finished at least one term in office. But lately, the IRS has essentially signaled that anything goes, granting favorable tax-exempt status to even such blatantly political groups as Crossroads GPS, masterminded by GOP operative Karl Rove, and a conservative Arizona group known as Americans for Responsible Leadership. Yale student Alex Jang is outraged at the sight of a stained glass window showing a slave kneeling before John Calhoun in one of the Ivy League University's residential colleges. Calhoun, a Yale graduate and a former U.S. vice president, once boasted slavery was a positive good. Now, Yale students are campaigning to change the name of Calhoun College to honor Roosevelt Rosie Thompson, an African-American Rhodes Scholar and student activist who died in a car accident in his senior year. Across America, students inspired by the Black Lives Matter movement are working to redefine civil rights activism beyond diversity and inclusion. Students are mobilizing to dramatically increase the number of African-American students and faculty on campus. The Christian Science Monitor observes that a new generation of activists has grown up in the age of Obama, America's first black president, and with the reality that mass incarceration has imprisoned a generation of black and Latino men. Many minority students are demanding that their own histories in the U.S. be acknowledged. Student groups are demanding more ethnic studies scholars, as well as curriculum requirements that all students become aware of what happened to their ancestors in America, and a more sophisticated understanding of how these histories affect the reality of their experiences today. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
For months now, Brazil has been embroiled in a swirling corruption scandal known as Lava Jato, or car wash, involving the state oil company Petrobras, construction contractors, the ruling Workers' Party, and opposition politicians. As the nation prepares for this summer's Olympic Games, Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff has been dogged by a slumping economy and an impeachment drive by conservative opponents who charged that she had cooked the books in the run-up to the 2014 presidential election. Prosecutors have attempted to implicate popular two-term president Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, known as Lula. In mid-March, prosecutors questioned Lula on allegations of money laundering involving a vacation home and a construction company, which the former president denied. When his successor, President Rousseff, sought to appoint Lula as her chief of staff, the move was seen by opponents as a way to shield Lula from possible future prosecution. A justice on Brazil's Supreme Court responded by blocking the appointment, which Lula has now appealed. Amid large anti-government and pro-government street protests, President Rousseff has charged that the allegations against her are false and part of a coup attempt to remove her from office, orchestrated by her political enemies. Your reporter spoke with Canadian journalist Ted Snyder, who discusses his recent article titled A Silent Coup for Brazil, which examines the current crisis in Brazil against the backdrop of the U.S. exercise of soft power in the post-Cold War era to destabilize and topple governments it viewed as adversaries in Eastern Europe and Latin America.
So what's going on in Brazil right now has the appearance of democracy in action, has the appearance of massive street protests against Dilma Rousseff's PT government, and it has the appearance of a noble judicial effort to bring members of the government up on corruption charges. So the way it's being presented in the North American media and in most of Brazil's media is sort of this model of mass democracy expressing itself in a really noble way. So you're getting impeachment attempts against Dilma Rousseff. You're getting former President Lula da Silva being held for questioning. You're getting people arrested for kickbacks and bribery. But what's scary about it is that it fits a pattern that's been occurring in Latin America but elsewhere in the world since the beginning of the Obama administration, since 2009, where things that look like democratic moves to improve government are actually coups that look like democracy. These are very different from the first stage of Latin American coups that, you know, that involved the Marines and guns, and then the second stage of coups that began in 1954 with the CIA covert coup in Guatemala. And the pattern that strikes me in the last few years is that these coups have gone even deeper into the shadows, where they don't look like coups at all. They actually look like democracy. I raised the question in my article of whether this appearance of democracy isn't just in fact part of this pattern of what I perceive to be a new style of coup.
I think to the casual reader of the U.S. corporate press, they would look at the stories written and the TV coverage of what's going on in Brazil and believe that there is a lot of evidence that would suggest the Workers' Party leadership has been corrupted and deserve to be held to account.
Yep.
How do you counter the notion that this is some kind of mass democratic rejection of the Workers' Party for this apparent corruption and not something more nefarious like an opposition party-led coup d'etat?
Yeah. So, Scott, I think there's two things or two or three things to be said to that. And the first is this thing called Lava Jato, this car wash or corruption cleaning. I think it did start as a sort of noble judiciary and police action against real corruption in the government. So I don't want to pretend that there's no corruption in Brazilian government or in the Workers' Party or the PT. There certainly is corruption. But I think that two things need to be said about that. The first is the specific charges brought up against the current president and the former president actually have nothing to do with Lava Jato, and they have nothing to do with corruption. The impeachment charge against Dilma Rousseff is that she used borrowed money to make it look like Brazil's budget was still on track. This is not an impeachable offense. It's not even an illegal offense. It's a common practice. So they've found no corruption charges against Dilma herself. So the attempt to impeach the president is actually outside of Lava Jato. It's outside of the corruption charges. Similarly, with Lula da Silva, the charges that have been brought against Lula are that he owns some beachside property that he claims not to own, and that he accepted money from corporations for giving speeches. Now, the two things we said about that is that neither one is illegal. Neither one's an impeachable offense. And more importantly, they both occurred after he was president. So although there's certainly corruption in the PT, the charges against the current and former presidents have nothing to do with the corruption. More importantly, the corruption was present in both parties. It was present in the PT and probably to a greater extent in the right-wing opposition, the PSDB. So it started off as finding dirt in both parties. But what happened is the car wash got carjacked, and it got transformed from finding corruption in both parties to shielding the PSDB and only really going after corruption in the PT.
So what is the role of Washington here in supporting what you contend is really a coup d'etat that is in part supported by external forces?
Yeah. Scott, I think that's the ultimate question. I think there are indications that there could be U.S. involvement, but I don't think that those indications have been proven yet. The reason that I raised the question, the article I'm suspicious of, is that the other countries that fit this pattern have been shown to have U.S. involvement. The two coups that happened first in South America this way were Honduras, when President Manuel Zelaya was taken out in a coup, in what looked like a constitutional move, and you had a constitutional coup. Shortly after that, in Paraguay, the same thing happened, also in Latin America, where the right-wing opposition seized power in the legislature, where they took advantage of a skirmish over disputed land that left about a dozen people dead. They unfairly blamed it on the left-wing president, Fernando Lugo. We know that the Americans knew about both of these coups because leaked documents, WikiLeaks documents and others show it. The pattern in Brazil is similar, so one wonders if it's backed by the states, and certainly there's that suspicion. So I don't think there's proof yet, but I think the pattern demands that we ask the question.
That was Canadian-based journalist Ted Snyder, who writes about the patterns in U.S. foreign policy and history. Find links to Snyder's recent article titled A Silent Coup for Brazil by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Solar power is booming across the United States, in part because the cost of solar panels has plummeted in recent years. The solar industry forecasts that roughly 20,000 megawatts of solar capacity will come online over the next 2 years, doubling the country's existing solar capacity, which today only provides a tiny fraction of the nation's overall energy mix. Residential rooftop solar panels that produce electricity are one of the fastest-growing sectors of the solar boom. But more than three-quarters of America's homes are not suitable for solar installation for a variety of reasons. However, these homes can benefit from what's called community solar, in which solar arrays are built in a separate location, and residents can buy into the system to receive electricity. But community solar is not available in every state, mostly due to opposition from the electric utility industry. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Tyson Slocum, director of the energy program at Public Citizen. Here he explains how solar installations work, why utilities often oppose these systems, and how community solar programs that target the participation of low-income groups can establish a business model that will allow the greatest number of people to benefit from solar energy.
There is no question that when you've got more and more customers generating their own electricity, either from their own solar panels that they own or generating power through a community solar program, that is in opposition to the financial interests of the incumbent distributional utility, because a utility earns money based on the sales of electrons to its customers. And if a larger proportion of its customers are not buying those electrons from the utility anymore, or in some cases, actually requiring the utility to buy electrons from them, in the case of a successful rooftop solar facility that is producing electrons in excess of what the household uses in electric power. So there is no question that the nature of the electric utility business model that's existed since the 1880s when Thomas Edison invented the first centralized power plant in New York City, we have to recognize that technology in the form of cost-effective rooftop solar requires dramatic changes in the corporate and business structure of electric utilities.
Tyson Slocum, how are solar systems funded? How are the different ways they are funded, and who benefits?
The primary way that rooftop solar owners can get compensated for their costs associated with buying and installing and operating these systems is through various tax subsidies. At the federal level, there's an investment tax credit that is set to phase out and expire over the next 5 years. And that simply allows you to take a tax credit based on the value of the cost of the solar system that you're installing on your rooftop. Depending upon the state or municipality, a number of different state and local tax incentives. But the biggest incentive that is featured in more than 30 states is something called net metering. And all net metering says is that if I am producing more electrons from my rooftop solar system than I am using in my household, that every month I can get credit on my electric bill for the excess electricity that my solar panels sold into the grid. But the amount of the payment that is provided to the solar owner is based upon the retail price of electricity. Now, if you've got 1% of households in a utility service area that are getting paid by other non-solar customers, that's not a big deal. But if 5% or 10% or 20% of all of a utility's customers are producing their own electricity from rooftop solar and are getting paid by customers that don't have rooftop solar, it does create an equity issue where those that have the financial or the technical capability to generate their own power from rooftop solar, they are going to see dramatically lower electric bills, and those customers that cannot afford access to rooftop solar or don't live in a building where it's possible because they live in a multifamily apartment building, they don't own their building because they rent, or if the building is just not in a suitable sunny place because of trees or whatever, they're going to see higher rates. So the problem has been that the utilities are saying, well, look, there's this cost shifting, and that's why we shouldn't do rooftop solar at all. That's not an excuse. The fact of the matter is all we need to do is to design programs that maximize not only the deployment of rooftop solar, but the equitable access to rooftop solar. And I think that the community solar concept is one of those ways that we can ensure that we get penetration of rooftop solar into low-income and other communities that otherwise might not be able to get it.
That was Tyson Slocum, Director of the Energy Program at Public Citizen. Learn more about the benefits of community solar programs by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Since the 2000 U.S. election, where Vice President Al Gore won the national popular vote but lost the White House to George W. Bush after a controversial Supreme Court decision that left thousands of crucial Florida votes uncounted, a growing number of Americans have lost faith in the machinery of U.S. elections. The skepticism only deepened when Robert F. Kennedy Jr., along with election protection activists Harvey Wasserman and Bob Fitrakis, presented documentation that accused Republican election officials of employing a wide range of illegal and unethical tactics to fix the 2004 election, where George W. Bush defeated his Democratic challenger, Massachusetts Senator John Kerry. The allegations focused on the state of Ohio and its 18 critical Electoral College votes, where, according to reports, at least 357,000 voters, the overwhelming majority of them Democratic, were prevented from casting ballots or did not have their votes counted in 2004. According to a recent article and forthcoming book by Wasserman and Fitrakis, U.S. elections are vulnerable to partisan dirty tricks using methods they call strip and flip. Historically, stripping has been based on race and centers on voter suppression tactics that includes the purging of minority voters from registration rolls, imposing restrictive voter ID laws, and establishing barriers to make voter registration and early voting more difficult for Democratic Party-leaning groups such as blacks, Hispanics, the young, and the poor. Flipping, they say, relates to electronic voting machines that are vulnerable to hacking and have no mechanism to verify vote totals, such as a paper trail. Your reporter spoke with author and activist Harvey Wasserman, who explains why he's concerned that the results of the 2016 national election could be open to manipulation and outright theft.
There's one thing that, and only one thing that you need to know about the 2016 election. There's many things, but the number one thing is the reality that 80% of the vote in the United States presidential election in 2016 will be cast on electronic voting machines, and they are completely unverifiable. There is no system in place in the United States in 2016 to verify the electoral outcome on these machines. Most of these machines were paid for with money that was voted by the Congress in 2002, the Help America Vote Act, and as a result, we will be conducting our election in this country. You know, millions of dollars spent all this time yelling, screaming, debating. But the bottom line is we're conducting this election on machines that are 10 years old. And, you know, I don't know anybody who has a personal computer or a cell phone that's 10 years old, or even a desktop. And these machines are so easily hackable that there was a public demonstration done not long ago where a professor took an electronic voting machine and played Pac-Man on it. You know, it's ridiculous. And there is no accountability on the state level, so that you have a situation in Ohio, Michigan, Illinois, Iowa, Arizona, and North Carolina where the governor and the secretary of state are both from the same party. And they can, at midnight, as was done in Ohio in 2004, simply flip the electronic vote count. And so the title of our book, which is forthcoming, is Strip and Flip Selection of 2016, because what they're doing is they're stripping, and there's a long history of this, of course, in the United States, they're stripping the voter rolls, mostly of African-Americans, Latinos, young people, people suspected of being liberals or progressives, and so that millions of Americans literally are being denied the right to vote. And then if that's not sufficient, then on election night, as happened in 2004, they can just flip the vote electronically and no one will know the difference. And, you know, we get accused of being conspiracy theorists all the time. All you have to do is answer the simple question. Tell us exactly how will the electronic vote count be verified in 2016? There is no answer. So we're voting in black boxes, and governors and secretaries of state will have the capacity to flip the vote count in a matter of about 60 seconds, however they want to do it.
Harvey, I did want to ask you about this proprietary software that powers up these electronic voting systems and machines that are purchased or leased by state government. How is it that state officials of one sort or another, or party officials, could actually get into the guts of the vote count itself to manipulate the results. What kind of collusion are you alleging between these government and party officials and the companies that manufacture the software for these voting machines?
Well, they issue contracts to run these elections to the owners of those machines or to companies that specialize in manipulating the nature of the machines. In Ohio 2004, there was a no-bid contract given to a guy named Mike O'Connell. The electronic machines for the Ohio vote count in 2004 were in the basement of a building in Chattanooga, Tennessee, that also housed the servers for the Republican National Committee and for Carl Rove's email. And the guy who, Mike O'Connell, who was charged with doing the tallying, was a longtime Bush family associate, who died mysteriously, by the way, in a plane crash, single-engine plane crash in 2008, while he was being deposed by us. You do have states do contract with companies to tally up the vote count, and while there's no public accountability, the governors and secretary of states are pretty much in charge of operating with the IT companies that do the vote count.
Well, Harvey, what are some of the important elements that you want our listeners to know about a sound plan to protect the vote in future elections?
Well, we advocate universal hand-counted paper ballots, a four-day weekend for national holiday for voting, universal automatic registration, with the registration rolls kept with a paper backup. The polls need to be run by students and elders working at $15 an hour. And we also, of course, need to get money out of politics. It has to be restored campaign finance laws. Abolish the Electoral College, for God's sakes. The Electoral College is ridiculous.
That was longtime activist, author, and organizer Harvey Wasserman, who, along with Bob Fitrakis, has co-authored 6 books on election protection, including their forthcoming PowerPoint compendium titled The Strip and Flip Selection of 2016. For more information and articles on election protection, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.